Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
The deal for the massive Foxconn plant is set for its final legislative approval today. What comes next for the $3 billion deal? The state budget is close as well. We'll look at what issues remain, what the changes mean, and what may draw Scott Walker's veto pen. Later today, a Milwaukee Common Council committee will discuss a report from the U.S. Department of Justice on the Milwaukee Police Department. We'll talk about what's at stake. Meanwhile, the Republican race for the U.S. Senate started to come into focus this week. So did the Democratic race for governor. We'll take a look at where the field stand. We'll also have winners and losers and take some viewer questions today on JS on Politics. Welcome to JS on Politics. I'm your host, Greg Borowski. We have a very full slate today. I'm joined here in the studio by Dave Haynes, our editorial page editor. He's usually in this seat. We're putting him in the other hot seat today. He's a former business editor and has written a lot about Foxconn. And we're joined from Madison by Patrick Marley, who we're going to go to first here about Foxconn. So the assembly is in session today. Very little doubt that the bill's going to be passed and the whole package. Patrick, tell us a little bit, though, about where it goes from here. You know, there's some idea that the governor might, you know, line item veto parts of it to make it even more to his liking. But what do you see coming out of this?
Yeah, so it'll clearly get done by early afternoon today, Thursday, and then it'll move on to the governor's desk. We just don't know when or where he will sign it, but he's obviously an enthusiastic supporter of this. Because it does include appropriations, he has a line item authority over it, so he can carve it up as much as he wants. I would not see significant changes, but he sure could take out a provision or two if it's not to his liking.
Yeah, are there any in particular that were inserted along the way that he might want to just drop out and get it back to where it started?
So there have been some changes since he introduced it. I think many of those were worked on with consultation with the administration and with Foxconn. We haven't heard about anything that he will veto, and so it's possible that he wouldn't. I'd say one provision that was added late in the game that has caused some questions is this changes to how litigation over Foxconn would happen. And it would allow cases to get to the state Supreme Court faster. And it would, if a circuit court made any decisions, those would automatically be suspended as soon as it was appealed to higher courts. Attorneys have really questioned whether the legislature can do that or if it's a separation of powers constitutional problem. So perhaps the governor would share those concerns and take them out. Or maybe he'll just leave that for the courts to figure out.
All right, let me ask you another sort of procedural question. There's a whole, I mean, for any effort of this size, there's, you know, local issues, there's water issues, zoning issues. Are there a lot of other mini hurdles that have to be overcome, or are those pretty well, you know, clear sailing here for the plant?
Yeah, I think the debate really shifts from sort of this state focus of lawmakers to the hyper-local issues. You know, it looks likely that this is going to wind up in Racine County. They're in final negotiations there with local officials. But then there will be any number of things that Mount Pleasant or whatever community it is will have to sort out, such as creating a TIF district, and this would be a TIF district unlike any the state has ever seen. Racine County does not have a local option sales tax, unlike most counties in the state. Racine County voters have been very resistant to having a local sales tax, but this would be a way for the locals to have additional resources to, you know, build up their police force and their fire stations and those kinds of things. Will they go down that road? I don't know. But lots of very local issues that we'll want to watch closely.
Yeah. Well, let's bring in Dave here. So you're a former business editor here at the Journal Sentinel and have followed this very closely. Let's take the step back view now. I mean, a month or two ago when this came up, people thought, you know, kind of poo-pooed the idea this would wind up in Wisconsin. Now it's happening. Is this a coup for the state? You know, for people who would look at it, open some eyes, I would imagine, to what's happening in Wisconsin.
Well, it could be economically a coup for the state if it happens as Governor Walker and indeed President Trump have predicted it would happen. 13,000 new jobs in the state, if that's what it ends up being, 6, 8, 10 years from now is a big deal. I would add politically, we'll get into this a bit more later, I think it's a big deal for Governor Walker and at almost, in my view, no risk to him. But the questions that are still out there, which won't be answered for quite a while, are will Foxconn actually create as many jobs as has been predicted? They've automated their plants in China tremendously. I was speaking with a journalist from Taiwan recently, and her view is that the plant here is sort of an experiment in a way to see if it's a great equalizer, automation, can make the costs of running the plant here relatively equal to the cost of running a plant with cheaper Asian labor.
Yeah, and Patrick, can you talk a little bit about how, I mean, there's concern among the Democrats and others about how closely this will be watched or how will WEDIC do with its efforts, if this just jumps things to the Supreme Court and through the DNR. I mean, what's the concern there in terms of the normal regulatory and, you know, statutory sort of steps that are going to be, you know, taken away in this process?
Yeah, you know, I think Republicans were a little surprised at how unified Democrats were against this incentive package. They thought they'd get quite a few Democratic votes. They really didn't. They got them from Democrats who were right in the immediate area and none of the others. For Democrats, they're concerned about the cost. They're also very concerned about the changes to the environmental rules. Basically, the legislation says that many of the requirements that would normally be in place for the environment for this project don't apply. So they don't have to get permits to build in waterways. They don't have to get permits to build in wetlands. They don't have to do an environmental impact statement. Democrats are very concerned about that, and they're very concerned that it will be used as a model to just wipe out those rules for other businesses. So I think that's their chief concerns here.
Greg, if I can jump in on one thing, too. The deal is structured so that it's $1.5 billion for the jobs themselves. That's pay-as-you-go, so no money goes out until those jobs are created. But there's $1.35 billion that's for plant and equipment. As of now, as Patrick has written, there's no minimum job requirement for that money. So conceivably, and this is a risk, I talked to someone yesterday who is very close to this deal who acknowledged there's about $1 billion at risk here that isn't tied to any job creation. So the risk is that Foxconn grabs those plant and equipment incentives legitimately, and in fact there'll be an economic benefit to the construction phase, no doubt about it, but then doesn't employ the plant in the way that they say they will. And so the cost per job for taxpayers goes up pretty enormously at that point.
Yeah, well, let's talk a little bit and sort of fast forward to next year at this time. Mm-hmm. So we'll be very close then on the election. Governor Scott Walker's up for a new term. None of these concerns will have played out in terms of will they have filled as many jobs as they claim, and is it a boondoggle, as some claim. So, Patrick, let me start with you. Is this just like a massive win for the governor on an electoral basis where he can cite this? And how do the Democrats position themselves to criticize it if it hasn't come to pass as they say it will?
Yeah, it's a good question because you're right that if the concerns of critics play out and the project is a failure, I think that won't be known until after November of 2018. So it looks like a short-term victory for the governor because not only will, if it doesn't go the right way, it won't become clear until later, but in the meantime, presuming that Foxconn moves as quickly as they say they want to, there'd be shovels in the ground, there'd be cranes, there'd be all kinds of hiring of construction workers and large purchases of, for local businesses. So that's all a good thing for the governor, particularly as it's perceived in southeastern Wisconsin. The question, I think, would be, are the Democrats able to position this for people who live in other parts of the state and contend that it doesn't really benefit them, that they, you know, once again, the lawmakers and the governor have done something just for the Milwaukee area, up north and in western Wisconsin and even in the Fox Valley. That's a concern. They feel like all the money from the state goes into the southeastern Wisconsin and not elsewhere.
Yeah. Let me just briefly, Dave, ask you on that point. So put on your Democratic strategist hat for a moment. What is your argument in the election next year to say, hey, Governor Walker, you brought in this massive investment from this company from overseas? That's a bad deal for the state. How do you?
I think the Democrats are in a box on this one, and I agree with Patrick. I think it's an unalloyed win for Governor Walker. politically and at very little risk, as I mentioned earlier, because as Patrick pointed out, we're not going to know by 2018 whether this works or not. In fact, we're not going to know for a number of years whether it works or not. And my guess is Governor Walker will be off making money somewhere or working for the federal government by that time. So I think it's a win. I think the Democrats have a very tough time criticizing this.
All right. Now, let's shift to the other big story in Madison today and this week, the state budget. So last night it made it through the Assembly, and it's got to the Senate where it's promptly held up by, you know, a small group of senators who want changes to it. Patrick, what's the latest on that?
So, yeah, if the path for Foxconn seems very clear, we know exactly what's going to happen with that legislation. With the budget, it is totally up in the air. The Assembly passed it yesterday on a largely, party-line vote. It comes to the Senate now. They've got a big majority there, 20 to 13, but there are four senators who have concerns about the budget. They're holding out. Three of them have put down a list of nine things that they want to see changed. The Assembly says, don't make changes to the budget. We're not coming back anytime soon. Scott Fitzgerald, the majority leader, is trying to get – all he needs is one vote, it appears, to get him to 17. He's out there lobbying for that, but I just talked to one of these senators. Sounds like he's pretty strong no, so I think it's going to be hard for them to find that last vote at least in the next day or so. Fitzgerald ideally would like to come back on Friday on the budget. I don't know if they're going to be able to do that.
Yeah, is there any way, just on a practical matter, they can sort of get the vote without having to change the budget itself, for instance, by doing, well, get the commitment by saying we'll take up a different bill or we'll handle that in a different piece of legislation so they can keep the budget moving? Or is it going to ultimately require the Assembly somehow to come back in a session?
Well, that is the key question. I mean, clearly, Fitzgerald's ideal is to get the budget passed as is, then it's completed, it's sent to the governor, and the show's over. If Fitzgerald makes any change, I mean, here's the challenge for Fitzgerald. One, the Assembly doesn't want to come back. But two, if he makes concessions to these four conservatives and gives them something, then moderates or other conservatives are going to say, well, wait a minute, if we're reopening budget negotiations, you know, I don't see this as a perfect document. I'd like to get X, Y, and Z. And all of a sudden you have a bigger amendment with maybe 12 or 15 changes. Then the Assembly members start saying, well, you know, hey, we think we could improve this budget as well, or I'd like to see this pet project or this provision. It gets to be pretty messy pretty fast.
Yeah. Well, let's, Dave, let me ask you this question. As we sort of similar to the Foxconn one, as we look ahead to the election next year, this is the budget that the governor will be running on. Is he happy with how it's turned out? I mean, is this a pretty good platform for him next year?
Well, I would think so. And as I believe it was Jason Stein, Patrick's colleague, wrote going back a few months now, but very different looking budget than we saw when Governor Walker was running for president, when he wanted to appear very conservative. This is a budget that of a politician that, and I think he's going to get it, that is appealing to a broader section of the state. He's running for governor again. And it appears to me that the governor is going to get most of what he wants here. I think the interesting thing about the budget debate, though, has been that, and I've written this, we're a one-party state, right? The Democrats are moribund, so on, so on. Well, actually, we are a two-party state. We have the road-building Republicans, and we have the other Republicans, and they've been knocking heads over the budget.
All right. Well, we'll leave the state-level budget discussion there and go to this segment now, which takes things down to the local level. All right, we're going to turn to local issues now. We're joined by Mary Spicuzza, one of our political reporters who covers City Hall especially, and Ashley Luthern, our public safety reporter. So, Mary, we were just talking about the state budget, and that obviously has trickle-down effects on City Hall and the city budget, which is coming up soon. What's the reaction at City Hall to how they're faring?
I think the city of Milwaukee feels like with each passing budget that they are kind of getting a bit of a gut punch. So obviously they've been calling for more shared revenue payments for quite a while. Mayor Barrett is now pushing to get permission from the state to do a half-cent sales tax, which does not seem likely, but he is saying that to avoid steep cuts to public safety, he needs to have some kind of other additional revenue besides this flat shared revenue payments that really haven't increased. So the city's also been kind of under the gun. There was an amendment put into the budget or provision that would prevent any kind of state or TIF money from operating the Milwaukee streetcar project, which the city has said in the past that they weren't planning on using those funds, and it's not even clear that this will affect the city, but I think they feel like some state lawmakers really don't like the streetcar, really don't like the city
of Milwaukee.
What's
the emblematic of the hill they have to climb to get that, I mean, especially with the Republican-controlled legislature, to approve a tax, you know, even if it's just a local thing. I mean, there doesn't seem a lot of opportunities there for what the city's hoping for.
No, and there was actually a provision, another provision introduced, which would say that essentially business districts' bids couldn't collect, they would kind of limit where they could get money to kind of do improvements in these business improvement districts. And again, it seems like something that they just kind of feels like Milwaukee. I think a lot of city officials feel like they're being targeted by state lawmakers.
All right. Well, the big issue at City Hall today isn't the budget. It's a totally different topic. I just want to ask you about this, Ashley. This is, they have a committee hearing today about the Department of Justice report, the draft of which we've seen and reported on. And tell us about what's going to happen at that meeting today.
So I think what we're going to see is a pretty robust discussion about what the draft report says. I would expect the police department and the fire and police commission, both of which were invited to this meeting, I expect to see representatives of both pushing back on a lot of the assertions within the draft report. They have consistently said, the department heads, that this is a draft, there are errors, there are inaccuracies. However, as some of the aldermen have pointed out, much of this information, even if it does not involve data, it actually involves interviews with people, and that interview probably wouldn't change, even if, you know, whether it's with an individual officer or with community members. So those concerns are still valid in the minds of council members.
Yeah, and let's just step back for a second on that report. This is part of this cooperative, you know, process they went through that Chief Flynn requested from the Department of Justice. And the idea in the report is to what? Outline improvements or find shortcomings, all of the above?
Yes, yeah. The idea of the collaborative reform report is for an outside party to come in, take a look at the police department, work with the police department to identify shortcomings and room for improvement, an initial assessment, which we were initially told would be released within 8 to 10 months, and that was when the process started, which was back in December of 2015. The initial assessment for other cities typically outlines how the department has done and what they need to do better and how to achieve that. And so then the federal government is supposed to provide some technical assistance to help the department make those reforms.
So, Mary, you spent a lot of time over at City Hall talking with the aldermen and things. What would you say is the temperature over there these days among the common council members with their satisfaction with the police department?
There's been a lot of frustration in recent months with aldermen feeling like the police department, especially Chief Flynn, has not been as responsive to them as they would like. They've wanted a push for more accountability. There was actually a measure introduced by Alderman Zielinski that would give the council the power to essentially fire the police chief, fire chief too, but I think they were really targeting the police chief in that one. So I think that there has been questions, frustration building for a while. It did seem to cool off a little bit, maybe over the September recess when they all went on vacation. And they did approve, once they came back, they approved this asset forfeiture money that had been held for quite a while. Then the Fire and Police Commission earlier this week did sign off on on Chief Flynn's pursuit policy plans that they had, you know, ordered him to change. Yeah. So it does seem like things are maybe calming down, but that might change at the meeting.
Well, let me flip the question here for you, Ashley. You've been talking with police department sources and people. What's their sense over there? Are they happy with how the council's operating? Are they frustrated as well?
I think there's a lot of frustration on both sides. Mary and I both had the opportunity to interview Chief Flynn before this draft report was something that we had in our hands and that we were reporting on. And at that time, we were talking about changes in the immigration SOP that the department has. And I think the chief really felt frustrated in that he was being unfairly accused, or at least it was being implied that he acted improperly from both the council and the FPC, the Civilian Oversight Board. And so I think there is perhaps a sense of embattlement over there. And I think there also is a lot of frustration among the rank and file that has been the same for a while. You know, people are frustrated about support from the council or from residents at large, but they also are frustrated maybe with staffing levels and worried about other things. And, you know, the draft DOJ report really does provide some insights as to how at least some officers feel. Again, this is just, we don't know who all they interviewed. We don't know how widespread this is, but there are definitely safety concerns on on their part as well.
All right. Well, this will play out on the budget side in the coming weeks. So you'll have coverage at jsonline.com, and this hearing will play out today on jsonline.com. So tune in and check out that story, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to shift our discussion now to politics. In 2018, we're joined by Bill Glauber, one of our political reporters who's been covering the Senate race. We've still got Patrick Marley from Madison. Bill, let me ask you, we've had a little more clarity this week on the Republican side for the U.S. Senate race with Vuk Mirian and Fitzgerald out. And tell us a little bit about the field and how that field is shaping up.
Well, right now it's a two-person field. I wasn't surprised Fitzgerald decided not to run. He was only going to run if the whole party lined up behind him. That wasn't going to happen. So now we have, so far, a two-person race between Leah Vukmir, very well-established conservative, versus Kevin Nicholson, a former Democrat, younger by a generation, a U.S. Marine veteran who has to show his conservative credentials to the base. And we're still waiting on Eric Hovde, the Madison businessman who was runner-up to former Governor Tommy Thompson in 2012. It looks like it's going to be a pretty healthy slugfest if it's a two-person race.
So either the two or if Hovde gets in, how do you see them positioning themselves? I mean, how do they measure out the electorate and what part do they go for?
They go right. Leah Vukmir has to do well in southeast Wisconsin. She, of course, is a state senator from Brookfield, and she's pretty well known in this market, very well known in talk radio, which will be important. Nicholson has to make his appeal, and what he plans to do is as an outsider. It'll be interesting to see if that works in a partisan primary, a Republican base that usually is fired up for its established candidates.
Right. Yeah. Patrick, let me ask you on Nicholson and his background, which obviously will become an issue of as a former Democrat who spoke at the Democratic National Convention in the past. How does he, present that to voters as a way to, and not become a liability for him in a primary like this?
Right. So what that means is in this Republican primary, he's going to be trying to position himself to the right of Leah Vukmir, who's one of the most conservative members of the Wisconsin State Senate. So it's going to be very interesting because, he hasn't been known until he came into this. He does have this Democratic past and, being pretty vocal about that when he was in the College Democrats, leading them nationally. Vukmir's people will be highlighting that quite a bit. Base Republicans will be skeptical of him, so he's going to be trying to show that he is a very conservative individual.
All right, and Bill, what are the odds that we see an ad with him and a picture of Ronald Reagan in it or Donald Trump as past Democrats who've became Republicans? Isn't that his case? Look, I saw the error in my ways.
That would be his case, but I think we're going to more and more see the ad of him speaking at the Democratic National Convention supporting a woman's right to choose. I think that's probably the ad we're going to see quite a lot of in the Republican primary. And then they're going to both attack Tammy Baldwin. She's come out for Medicare for All. She's the only sort of swing state Democrat to come out for Bernie Sanders' single-payer health care bill. So we'll see how that plays out.
Yeah. Patrick, let's talk to you now about the other race on the ballot that's taken a little more shape this week with Mike McCabe entering the race for governor. Talk a little bit about that field and that primary, which is, it's about a year away now.
Yeah, so it's really interesting because I think a few months ago people were wondering who is going to run as a Democrat against Scott Walker, who's looking, like he's in a really good place right now. And now the question is who's not going to run. We've got sort of four major candidates so far, others in the wings potentially running. So the field is getting very crowded, and we don't know how quite everyone is going to position themselves. I'd say Mike McCabe, the former head of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, a liberal group that advocates for campaign finance reform. He's clearly going to position himself on the left end of the spectrum. It'll be interesting to see where the others kind of go out. Some will maybe wanting to save some piece of the middle for the general election. But it's a little unclear where everybody's going to land right now.
All right, let me ask each of you for a prediction on this one. Do you think that next year the two top races will be in tandem in terms of partisan, or will there be a split? For instance, with the both incumbents, Baldwin and Walker win, or is it more likely to be, that Republicans win both or Democrats win both?
I think I could see very much the two incumbents winning. I think going into the race, both Walker and Baldwin would be favored. And it's happened before. I mean, 1 year, I guess, Tommy Thompson annihilated Ed Garvey and Russ Feingold was reelected. So we've seen a Republican win for governor and a Democrat for Senate.
Yeah, and Patrick, what's your best guess? In tandem or a split at the top of the ticket?
More than a year away, it's hard to say. I would tend to agree with Bill. Like, at the moment, the two incumbents look the most strongly positioned in those races. But, you know, increasingly, people are polarized. They tend to vote in one way. We saw in recent elections, it's sort of like winner take all, these big sweeps. So let's see what the climate's like come, you know, late summer next year. And that may tell us whether we're going to go back to this history of ticket splitting or if we're going to have like a good year for Dems or a good year for Republicans and a terrible year for the other party.
All right. Well, let's go to our winners and losers now. And Patrick, I'm going to start with you for your winner of the week.
So I would have liked to have had my winners and losers be Republicans in leadership. We could say, you know, whether they won on this budget issue or whether they lost on this budget issue. But things are in such flux, I can't tell you. You know, by the end of the day, the budget might be resolved and Scott Walker and Scott Fitzgerald are big winners. Or it could be a total mess and we have months left of the budget. So my winner is going to be Gordon Hintz. He has emerged as the likely next leader of the Assembly Democrats. Peter Barkas decided last week that he was going to step down after a caucus in which he was questioned by his members. So come later this month, it appears everybody's rallying around Gordon Hintz. Now, the question is this a prize worth winning? They are deep in the minority in the Assembly, but for the moment, he will be their leader.
All right. And Bill, your winner from the week.
Well, Acting Sheriff Richard Schmidt in Milwaukee County has taken over for David Clark. He's put his imprint on the department very quickly. He's going to deal with a $5 million budget deficit that's left behind, going to try to close that as fast as he can. And he's going back to old school traffic enforcement. So hard to say if he's going to get the job, but he's made the proper steps early on.
All right, so I shouldn't speed going home over the home bridge, is that what you're telling me today?
Especially do not speed in these construction zones.
Okay, all right, and you're a loser of the...
Well, the Milwaukee County taxpayers who had been taking a hit for security for former Sheriff David Clark. This is not, you know, there were threats against Mr. Clark, but, you know, a $250,000 tab on security for the former sheriff, and it could be as much as $500,000. So, once again, Milwaukee County taxpayers take it in the shorts.
All right. And, Patrick, your loser from the past week.
My loser for the week is Representative Ron Tussler. He's from the Menasha area. He came very close to getting a budget provision that would have put a railroad crossing on his own street. The Republicans in the legislature took that out at the last minute yesterday. We didn't actually find out about what that was until after it had been taken out. Leaders say that it was a mistake to put it in the first place, that they actually didn't mean to. Some have been a little skeptical of that claim, but Tussler almost got a railroad crossing. Instead, he got an embarrassing headline.
Doesn't that mean all politics is local, Patrick? Except maybe a little too close.
It always is. All right, gotta check who lives on Fire Lane 12.
All right, let's try to squeeze in a reader question or two if we can. So this short answer is my request here. So, Patrick, let me ask you this one. This is from Bob, who says, so is Donald Trump a Democrat now or maybe a Democrat again? And I think he's referring to the DACA and these other agreements that the president's making with the Democrats.
And I would say, what time is it, is the answer to that question. You know, he's been working with Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi recently. That has raised great concerns among Republicans, both in Congress and voters. But who's to say? It's very difficult to understand where the president is at any given moment. He seems to change his mind from time to time. So, you know, is this a long-term deal or is this, you know, something that can blow up tomorrow? I don't have any better prediction of that than, you know, your average viewer or average reader that's paying attention to what's
going
on.
All right. And, Bill, let me throw this in to you. This is from the reader's identity is All Hat, No Cattle. And it says, where do taxpayers go to get the refund on Clark's security costs now that he's gone?
Nowhere. It's gone.
It's gone.
It's gone.
Yeah. You go to your wallet.
Yep.
That's where you had it, and it is gone. All right. On that note, we'll end our show for today. You can read more about all these stories on jsonline.com. And we hope you join us next week at the same time. Thank you.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.